signal going out so that you can enjoy all of our cable programming, there is a way for you to minimize its impact on your normal listening life. Get your pledges in early, and you will help bring the membership drive to a quick and effective close.
Right.
And you'll also be entering yourself in for what is about the most remarkable prize package I've ever seen us put together.
That sounds pretty great. And also, we're going to be, for folks who are volunteers, we're going to be using our online sign-up for this drive for the first time. And I really like the drives because I get to know folks more and sit and chat with folks while we're welcoming people to becoming members. So we have a couple more of... Oh, we don't have too much time, though.
No, but if you can squeeze it in the next, say, 20 seconds.
Well, I just wanted to mention the Abortion Access Bowl-a-thon, which is happening Saturday, April 25th, and the Portland Renters Assembly, which is happening Tuesday, April 21st. So folks can go to our KBOO website to find out more about those. And thanks to everyone for all your support and for all you do for KBOO.
Thank you very much, Monica, and thank you everyone out there listening to us. Have yourself a wonderful evening, and we'll talk to you again next week.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is Occupy Radio from the Occupy Radio Collective. And first, these important messages.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Portland Renters Assembly, happening Tuesday the 21st from 5:30 to 7:45 p.m. at the Central Library in downtown Portland, and Sunday the 26th from 1 to 3 p.m. at the North Portland Library. The Portland Renters Assembly is a gathering of people united by the burden of rent and committed to housing as a human right. There'll be a chance for individuals to tell their stories about skyrocketing rents, no-cause evictions, dubious fees, and other kinds of exploitation carried out in the name of rent. There'll be childcare, snacks, and a chance to get connected to resources for moving forward together. For more information about the Portland Renters Assembly, go to kboo.fm and click on the right side for community events.
Tune in to KBOO Monday, April 27th through Friday, May 2nd from noon to 4, and Saturday and Sunday, May 2nd and 3rd from noon to 5 p.m. to hear our live broadcast from the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, brought to you by our friends and colleagues at WWOZ in New Orleans. We'll have access to 5 stages of fantastic traditional and contemporary New Orleans jazz and blues, brass bands, and interviews and commentary by the best that WWOZ has to offer. That's the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, starting Monday, April 27th. The weekdays, we'll broadcast it from noon to 4 p.m., and Saturday and Sunday, May 2nd and 3rd, we'll broadcast the festival from noon to 5 p.m., here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Occupy Radio, today we go again to our friends at the Occupy Eugene Media Group, Getch and Rivera-Sunt, as they speak with Christian Christman, author of Taxonomy of Peace, and Mickey Sakara, Maine water activist, about efforts to protect watersheds in Maine from pipelines. This coming Saturday is the Portland State University Students United for Nonviolence event, Visionary Voices. That's Saturday, April 18th, 8:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. at PSU's Hoffman Hall. Author and lawyer Sherry Mitchell will be joined by Occupy Radio co-host Rivera-Sunt as they discuss their efforts at facilitating peace events around the country. That's this coming Saturday, April 18th, all day, Hoffman Hall on the PSU campus. PSU's Students United for Nonviolence hosts Visionary Voices and authors Rivera-Sunt and Sherry Mitchell. Let's go now to Occupy Radio and your hosts for tonight, Getch and Rivera-Sunt.
From KWVA in Eugene
and the Occupy Eugene Media Group, this is Occupy Radio, an extended conversation about the issues which gave rise to the Occupy movement. I'm your host, David Getchy, Sierra Lupe.
So often people see the enemy as the aggressor, just a bad dude, you know, with bad motives. And there are aggressive, bad people in the enemy, but there are also good people with positive motivations. And if we don't look at those positive motivations, we're going to really miss our chance to create peace. And if we just hit back with hostility, it's going to make everything worse because we're not trying to solve the problems and we're not addressing these positive motivations.
Peace is a language our nation doesn't speak very well, occupiers. So this week on Occupier Radio, we talk with Kristen Christman, the author of Taxonomy of Peace, and find some language and concepts for this unknown landscape. Also, Nikki Sakara, a water activist from Maine, shares a story of the Penobscot Nation's struggle to protect the Penobscot River from pollutants and pipelines.
Howdy, occupiers, and welcome to Occupy Radio. I'm David Getchy, Sierra Lupe, and you can all call me Getch. I'm talking with Rivera Sun, who is in, unfortunately, sunny California, and on tour with her new book, Billionaire Buddha, and teaching nonviolence all over the place. How's life, Rivera?
Well, it's pretty good, actually. We did get a little sprinkle of rain last night here in Petaluma, California, and everything is amazingly green. It's just that time of year when you just cannot stop the spring, as we said in Occupy. Mm-hmm. It really happens. The hillsides are green, and that was Fancy, the Meta Center dog, which is actually the neighbor's dog that they just borrow from time to time. So if our listeners here are furry friends saying hello on Occupy Radio this morning, that's the reality of being on the road and sharing the adventure with you all.
Right. So you're in Petaluma, and you're teaching your nonviolence workshop, which you will be bringing to Eugene in less than a month, Eugene,
that's
Oregon.
That's right. April 19th, actually, at the Quaker Friends Center. Mm-hmm. We will be doing a whole afternoon workshop, and we just did this workshop yesterday at the Arlene Francis Center in Santa Rosa, and it was amazing. It was very powerful, very mind-expanding. I learned a lot from it, which is always a goal as a facilitator, to let yourself be open to the learning process as well as those who are partaking of what you're bringing and sharing as a skill. And what's exciting is to actually get to do this all over the country and actually meet real people who are getting their hands into the work of making change.
And do you, who's coming to your workshops? What kind of people are you seeing there?
I'm seeing everything, actually. Older people, younger people. We had a high school student there yesterday, which was very inspiring, I'll have to admit, to imagine this young man's life now that he's hung out with all of us nonviolent organizers. Older peace and justice activists who've been doing it for a long time, but are in a continuous process of deepening their understanding and skill set. And, you know, that was just yesterday. I remember, occupiers will remember, that I was back in Florida in February and really working with a lot of different communities, the homeless community, people working against mass incarceration, even suburban communities that are also working on different aspects of this culture of violence that we are all being steeped in. That this is actually a major problem in our world, that I just see more and more people recognizing that violence is not just when someone takes out a gun and shoots you. Violence is in the way we treat our earth, the way we treat human beings through our capitalist destructive system. And that we have to take a real stark look at this and work on it from many, many angles.
which you're doing all up and down the West Coast right now, but I guess you're heading back to New Mexico pretty soon.
Right. We'll take a brief hiatus at high altitude before coming out to Eugene. And also up in Portland area, we're going to do a day at PSU, Portland State University, doing a really great version of this workshop with some new additions that I'll put in just special for that workshop.
Oh, I'm going to miss it by a day.
I know. But then you get the Eugene version. They're always a little different. You know, they're in an organic process, and I try to really listen to the group and what they're asking for and bring aspects out for that group that I wouldn't necessarily bring out for another group. You know, that's the beautiful thing about the lineage of nonviolence is that we have so much knowledge and skill sets at this point, everything from not doing violence to oneself, to interpersonal nonviolence or nonviolent communication skills or conflict resolution skills or strategy for nonviolent social political movements. It's very, very diverse field and a lot of things to bring out in relationship to what a group is looking for at that point in their lives.
And leads perfectly into our discussion with Kristen Chrisman this week on the taxonomy of peace. I heard about Kristen on Talk Nation Radio, hosted by David Swanson on the Occupy the Media Collective, and couldn't wait to talk with her because I was very enchanted by her vision of transforming the world by looking at conflicts in a totally new and different way. So let's go talk with Kristen. We're talking today with Kristen Chrisman, who is the author of Taxonomy of Peace. And you can find that on the internet by searching for Paradigm for Peace. Kristen lives in upstate New York, where she publishes a lot in her local press on this topic. And we're going to expand that quite a bit over the next half hour and explore with Kristen the concept that we're approaching our conflicts from a destructive and unproductive fashion. And so, Kristen, like I said before, I'm looking very much forward to this conversation, and thank you for coming on Occupy Radio.
Thank you so very much, Getz and Rivera. Thank you.
Kristen, let's start by diving right into what this taxonomy of peace is. I mean, it's a big, long word. It's hard to pronounce, but what is behind it?
It's a large work on the internet that I wrote during a period of 10 years following 9/11, and it runs the Middle East U.S. conflicts through a model called Paradigm for Peace that I created in the fall of 9/11. And this model offers a very different approach to foreign policy. I can go into it in detail, but right now, just to summarize, there's four parts to the model. It looks at the roots of violence, it looks at escalators of violence, solutions to violence, and it looks at it emphasizes a quest attitude of cooperative dialogue. And the way in which it's very new is that I'm seeking to resolve conflict rather than taking sides and arming one side against the other, as we so often do with our weapons shipments. And the model looks at aggressive and defensive roots of violence in the enemy and in ourselves, because so often people see the enemy as the aggressor, as just a bad dude, you know, with bad motives. And there are aggressive, bad people in the enemy. But there are also good people with positive motivations. And if we don't look at those positive motivations, we're going to really miss our chance to create peace. And if we just hit back with hostility, it's going to make everything worse because we're not trying to solve the problems and we're not addressing these positive motivations. And the model's also different because it emphasizes nonviolent solutions. When you look at this wide category of roots of violence, this route, you realize, you know, bombs and drones and even sanctions aren't helping. They're hurting. And we need nonviolent solutions to fix these problems. Because often you hear about politics and economics and the military, but this model also looks at issues such as love, friendship, alienation, meaningful purpose in life, people's capacity for inner peace, their access to truth, values, and these things are all sadly neglected in foreign policy, and they all need nonviolent solutions. And the other thing that's different is because the model emphasizes cooperative dialogue, it's a model in which you have two people sitting on the same side of the table trying to solve a problem, trying to solve a puzzle together, where we look at the strengths and weaknesses of our perspectives together, instead of having two people on opposite sides of the table fighting it out.
I think that's something that you have mentioned a bit on the website and in some of your articles, is this dynamic of conversation between people that's fostered in the U.S. In debates, in sporting matches, in our congresspeople, where in the business world especially, where the object of sitting down at a table is to dominate the other person and to come out the victor, which is kind of like a pugilist mentality towards conversation.
Exactly. It's verbal war.
Yeah. What are the alternatives to that? You just mentioned the Quest model, which maybe we should talk about a little bit, and then also cooperative dialogue. I mean, it'd be amazing to imagine Bill O'Reilly engaged in cooperative dialogue instead of vicious attacking. But talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, well, different writers have written about it, and different cultures have different names for it. I call it a Quest dialogue. It's a cooperative dialogue where you transform the conflict into a group problem-solving activity. And you really have to have an attitude of, I think of it as bold amiability. You boldly express your own opinion. You don't try to hide your ideas, but you're very amiable and friendly, and you care about the other side. You really have to care. And before I worked on the taxonomy of peace, like the beginning steps of it, I initiated a Quest dialogue with a great friend of mine in the area, because we had different points of view about foreign policy in Afghanistan and Iraq. And it was really good to work with a friend on this, because we both respected each other and we cared about each other. But even with a friend, if you have different points of view, things can go wrong. You know, you can become enemies. So we worked on a cooperative dialogue by email, in which we were so friendly towards each other. We said what we thought, and we really tried to get into the other person's shoes. And that's the key. I think that's what, when they say, you know, love your enemy or love your neighbor, loving someone actually means trying to get into their shoes and seeing life through their point of view. And it really helped seeing her point of view. It helped refine my ideas and make them better. And that's the thing. With cooperative dialogue, you're not only going to get friendship out of this, you're going to get better solutions. You're going to have fuller access to the truth and to understanding. You're going to get better solutions. And we need to change that, even in schools where you have debate clubs. I wish they had Quest clubs, or, you know, cooperative dialogue clubs, or in these campaigns where the men are just, it's usually men, are just fighting it out and trying to look great and how they're competing in their ideas. But they would be much more impressive to me if they could see something good in each other and work on that together.
I like the concept of the Quest dialogue, though. I like the idea that when you're confronted by hostility or the potential for hostility, instead of raising your hackles up, you get together with your potential enemies and you say, okay, well, what is the problem? And look at the problem and then embrace it as a challenge to both sides to resolve together.
If you can start with friends of different points of view, I think that's a great way to start, because it can be very hard for people who've been maybe killing each other's families to actually engage in a cooperative dialogue or any kind of talk. But if we work on it piece by piece, start at the level of friends, and then we eventually maybe work with somebody from a different political party or somebody from another country, and we can build this habit.
I have a saying that discourse is the foundation of democracy, and it's intentionally discourse, not debate. But, you know, you mentioned that when you started writing all this work on peace and conflict resolution, that it was right after 9/11. Now, famously, the Dalai Lama, when asked about what he would have done about 9/11, he replied that, this was many years afterwards, he replied that he would have found out why they took the action of flying into the World Trade Centers, which was a radical idea for America at the time. We didn't really ask why. We went and bombed Iraq, which we can kind of Just to remind our listeners that that had nothing to do with 9/11, because we always have to remind our country that that's true.
I want to interrupt here for a second, mm-hmm. Rivera. We actually have had a guest on who asked why we had, you know, terrorists, well, I'll say for easy labeling, decided to fly airplanes into the Twin Towers, and he was censured by his university and pilloried in the press. So it was the exact opposite. Yeah, you taking the steps that Kristen is recommending actually brought harm to him.
Well, you know, as it points out, there were Americans asking why. Probably you both were asking why. I was asking why. Why did they attack on 9/11? And really wanting to know the reasons. And the thing is, if that's shut up inside the United States, it shows that, we don't even have cooperative dialogue within the country. So how do we expect to have good relationships with other countries if even amongst Americans we're repressing each other? Why didn't the president and other people invite people who are asking why to talk with them? We could, in a friendly way, you know, we could have learned so much. You know, they could have expressed their fears about the terrorists. We could have talked about terrorist motivations. We could have created a much more comprehensive policy.
Why do you suppose that was the dominant paradigm? What was there a group that clearly benefited from not addressing this in an open and solution-seeking fashion?
There are probably a combination of reasons why that didn't happen. One is, maybe some people benefited because, for some reason, they wanted us to attack Afghanistan. Maybe there's, you know, the pipeline. Maybe they wanted the pipeline deal to go through that the Taliban wasn't accepting. So maybe they find advantage in gaining wealth or power. But I think a lot of it, too, is just tradition and kind of a status sort of thing where it's almost, instead of a democracy, as if they feel like it's a monarchy where, if you ask us questions, it's an insult to us. Or, I'm not sure. I think it's a conformity, a tradition.
I think that we could see very clearly that there were certain people in high up political positions in the United States that are very much invested in and profiting from the military-industrial complex. And for them, this borderless war on terror that they rolled out like a cookie cutter right after 9/11 served them very well, and it's continuing to serve them. Which kind of brings me to another angle on this question. You know, 9/11 is not water under the bridge. It's still something that very much shapes our current reality, our current problems, and also our Middle Eastern foreign policy. And, you know, you had mentioned, Kristen, that you are applying the taxonomy of peace to the Middle East and particularly to Iran, which is it's all part of that, maybe, but maybe a slightly different angle on it. Maybe we should go in that direction and explore what might a taxonomy of peace approach look like to our Middle Eastern conflicts.
Oh, great. Well, first, let me say that in the roots of violence section of the model, I look at 8 categories, including life, power and freedom, wealth and possessions, values, love, self-potential, joyful tranquility, and truth. I look at all of these as roots of violence. Then I look at mental, legal, and physical escalators of violence, which are those factors making it more likely a person will choose violence in response to a situation. But I want to mention that for the solutions, I have 3 categories of solutions, and I like to think of them as the protons, neutrons, and electrons in the atom of peace. I mean, we have all this talk right now about nuclear power, nuclear weapons, and I think it'd serve us better to spend a lot more time and energy talking about the atom of peace than uranium and plutonium. And I just want to explain them, because protons, when you think protons, think happiness, friendship, love, truth. They're the mental tools to help improve human relations and to improve access to truth. They're about prejudice reduction. They're about cooperative dialogue. And you'll notice that protons are completely absent from foreign policy, and they have been for 200 years. But they're the most important solution. And you might ask, why the neglect? I think maybe they're considered soft or unrealistic or unmasculine. But then when you look at Ferguson and Staten Island, you notice that the police in black communities, they're not asking to bomb each other or torture each other. They're asking for the protons. They're asking for better positive relations, for understanding. And if we could apply that internationally, it would help a lot. So a lot of my solutions have to do with these protons. And the neutrons are the legal tools to create justice and equality. For example, fair representation in government, economic equality, closing the income gap. And electrons are the ones we always hear about. They are the physical tools to prevent violence. They're also necessary, but not nearly to the extent that we use them, and we use them so destructively, because they don't need to be bombs and drones. They can be just defensive security. They include, in your neighborhood, they include just having a lock on your door. They include surveillance and monitoring other people's military activities. But all three particles are important to create a stable, positive relationship with the world, with a heavy dose on the protons and neutrons. So now when we look at terrorism or Iran, and I run through these categories, like a big grievance of terrorists is the repression that they were under by dictators who are frequently supported by the United States. And by supported, it means financially supported. Weapons were shipped to them. And their internal security services were so brutal. And the torture that political prisoners underwent literally created radicalism, and it made them determined to fight back against their governments, against the United States. And in Iran, there's also horrendous torture. And the United States is not supporting that, so that's why the young Iranians don't hate us so much as Muslims do in other countries. But we also have to, I think, in these negotiations right now, really focus on the human rights. So I would say, when you're looking at this threat to life that Muslims, whether they're in Iran or in other countries, are facing, we have to use protons. The United States president has to speak out a lot against torture, including against U.S. torture at the secret sites in Guantanamo, but speak out a lot against it, not just issue a formal statement against it, but talk a lot about it. We need to have neutrons, which are the legal policies, like tie these negotiations with Iran into respect for human rights. And we need to have electrons, such as surveillance of the activities in the prisons in Iran to make sure that human rights are not being violated. That would be an approach I would take to help resolving that root of violence. Another root of violence is threats to power and freedom. With terrorists, many are angered because Islamists are not represented in their governments, and the United States has a bias against Islamists, as if they're all violent or all extremists. And again, there needs to be a cooperative dialogue developed. Again, that's a proton, developing cooperative dialogue. In Iran, a problem with power is that even if you have a reformist parliament and a reformist president, you've got the supreme leader, and you've got the guardian council who can basically trump anything, because the parliament has tried to pass, they passed bills to increase respect for human rights, but it's just been dismissed by the guardian council. So those types of problems can be addressed, again, with protons and neutrons. The protons can teach cooperative dialogue. The protons can bring Muslims back to some of their own principles of, I don't remember which is which, but there's Shura, Ijma, and Masla, and they basically relate to Abraham Lincoln's government of the people, by the people, for the people. We need to remind in Iran, if the clerics want to have this Islamic government, well, if they have a real Islamic government, they'll be paying attention to this type of thing. And then, again, with neutrons, those are legal policies, we can tie some of these requests into negotiations. Another problem is sharing power. The United States is so dominant around the world, militarily, politically, economically, culturally, that it's very threatening to people. And if the U.S. expects, say, Iran to not have nuclear weapons, which, I mean, I wish that nobody would have nuclear weapons, but the United States ought to give up some of its own power in certain ways, like guarantee that we're not going to step on your toes with economics, and we're not going to force you to have the Shah of Iran as your leader. I can go on with other examples if you'd like.
Well, at this point, though, we're going head-to-head sort of with Iran. And, you've just laid out the difficulties we have in coming together and such. So if our government were working from a taxonomy of peace, what would Obama do first thing when he was confronted by Iranian intransigence, let's say? What would be his first step under the taxonomy for peace?
Well, I think there are several things. One of the important things is, if you're dealing with, as they call them, the protons, the tools of friendship, love, truth, is he should look at developing a respect for human rights in Iran by increasing truth about Islam, because the clerics are saying that women are inferior. I'm talking now about violence within Iran, violence to women and violence to civilians. I'm not talking about the nuclear weapons right now, but the human rights issue. And Muhammad actually gave a lot of respect to women. He gave equal respect for male and female morality and their spirituality. He did not require all women to be covered by the veil, just the wives of Muhammad. It was done as a status, symbol of status more. But this custom of clothing the women completely and subjugating them is actually from a pre-Islamist Persian custom. So that's how I call it a proton, how increasing knowledge of truth can help resolve some of the violence within Iran. It's by education, by talking about what the Islamic beliefs really are. Now,
it just occurs to me that, you know, the United States of America, while being having a separation of church and state, predominantly is a Christian country. But we, in the Christian tradition, they do have a concept of let you who is without sin throw the cast the first stone. You know, and the very problems that you're describing in Iran, I see as very prevalent in the United States, which is that we do not have a respect for human rights. We do not have economic justice. We do not have an equal respect for women. And, you know, I think that we can talk about degrees on that last one about women within different societies. But I think, you know, if we're going to look at those protons, those positive endeavors, a real stark look at ourselves before we go trying to preach to everyone else in the world is really a necessary thing.
I think... When we talk with Iran about their internal relations, the human rights issue and the gender equality, we should be talking about, in our own country as well, the problems. I think you're right, even if there are differences of degree. I think that's a great way to do it, because it will help our country, and it will not be having a paternal attitude towards Iran in that way. I think you're
and imagine if
right.
If Obama, instead of going and saying you need to stop your human rights violations or else XYZ, went mm-hmm. and said, hey, you know, we have a problem with torture in our country too, and the political situation for me is extremely challenging in closing Guantanamo. Wow, imagine that conversation. Wouldn't you love to be a fly on the wall
awesome.
At
that would be great if Obama and the Iranian president and the if they talk together about their problems. I agree with you exactly. You're right on. Yes, and that way we can solve problems in both countries instead of always the U.S. telling every other nation what to do. Other nations maybe can give ideas to us.
That would be great, huh?
Yes, I agree with that completely. And it's the same with, I like tying in issues at different levels of society. For example, in Iran you have women dominated by men, and the United States expects that should stop. I mean, and it should. But at the same time, you have the United States dominating other nations. So I think a nice talk would be about this whole problem of dominating others, this obsession with hierarchy and having others obey. And the United States can say, hey, you know, we see that we shouldn't be dominating in so many ways. Like, we shouldn't have taken out Mossadegh and reinstalled with the Shah. We shouldn't be pushing our own capitalist economic beliefs around the world. And you also, why don't you work on your relations between men and women? I felt the same way with Iraq, that the United States shouldn't be dominating in the Mideast, but at the same time, Saddam Hussein should not be dominating his civilians. And if they could talk about that together and the damage that that relationship has, it would help. And I've read in a book, it's by Gordon Allport, The Nature of Prejudice. He talks about two types of personalities, the prejudiced personality and the democratic personality. And the prejudiced personality is somebody, not just a prejudice, but they have black and white thinking. They believe in one set of rules, unquestioning obedience to one set of rules. And they find that this type of personality comes from a childhood often where themes of obedience and threats loomed large and there were relationships of power rather than love. So I don't know how much that is creating this domination obsession in different countries. And it's something that should be talked about.
I wonder, does all of this that you're, all of the taxonomy of peace fit within Denis Kucinich's idea of the cabinet position of, I don't remember what it was, the Department of Peace, that's what it was.
You bet it does, yeah. In fact, his work, his bill inspired my own development of the paradigm for peace model because I read his bill right after 9/11 and I just loved it. But then I was thinking, you know, I'm kind of picky sometimes, and I'm thinking, you know, I think I would organize the department a little differently, and I was thinking, how would I organize the pursuit of peace? And that's how I came up with this whole model of looking at the roots and looking at the solutions. But the department would be terrific because a department like that would bring in the protons, you know, the mental tools, it would bring in the neutrons, the legal tools, and not just these physical tools, the electrons, which the Department of Defense is in charge of. Like, whenever there's a conflict, for some reason it's just the National Security Council and the Department of Defense that make these decisions. And there should be somebody talking about all these other issues. And that's why we need a Department of Peace.
I think we're actually starting to bridge into a really interesting time period because of Erica Chenoweth and Maria J. Steffen's work that has empirically proven that in many of the situations that we try to use violence to resolve, nonviolence is actually twice as successful.
Mm-hmm.
And cheaper, which is the terribly ironic and beautiful part of that, which, of course, you know, so much of our conflict is not about actually resolving conflict or even winning the war. It's actually about profits and I always call it reducing inventory on a big spree and spending sale so that then the government needs to buy more bombs and tanks. It's a really terrible, terrible perspective, but I think we need to realistically look at our foreign policy from the perspective of the military-industrial complex, that they're not in it to stop wars. They're in it to make more money. But, you know, with the knowledge that nonviolence actually works, and it works extremely well, and now to have the empirical data set from people who study violent conflict, that's the interesting part of Erica and Maria's work. We're starting to enter an era in nonviolence and all kinds of conflict resolution where this whole category of action that has been in development for not actually that long in human history, although we have lots of examples going back and back and back. It's gone through an escalation phase in the past 150 years. That we actually, you know, we're in a whole new world of what would it look like if we actually established a Department of Peace, actually trained our citizens in civilian nonviolent defense, actually used nonviolent methodology for resolving major conflicts like expelling foreign invasions and ending occupations. I think we have a whole lot of opportunities unfolding before us. So with your taxonomy of peace work, what is your process right now with trying to get this knowledge and this process out into the world and under consideration for actual implementation?
I've been, in the beginning, I often wrote different officials in the government. I tried submitting articles to journals. I've had some op-eds in the Times Union. I speak when I can. But it's a slow process, and I'm not really sure how to get it out to the world. I have my project on the internet, and I have it chopped up into little pieces, little articles for people who want shorter bits. But I'm not sure. But can I say something else about how I would approach the terrorism and, mm-hmm. and the conflict? I'll try to be brief. It's the values topic and the topic of love, friendship, and worth are really important, because with values, it was Ataturk's drastic program of westernization of Turkey that led to the formation of the Muslim Brotherhood as an asocial, as an apolitical social organization. And it was Sayyid Qutb, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, but he wrote a work about his 1948 trip to the United States. He had very negative perspective on the United States. But his work has heavily influenced Muslim radicals. And I don't know, why aren't our presidents talking about the pros and cons of westernization? Why aren't they leaping to read this book and talk about whether it's accurate or not and the validity, cooperatively with the Middle East? Same with the Shah, his program of westernization. That led to the opposite reaction. It's like an action and reaction and values of westernization. And that's just another thing we could have a cooperative dialogue about, and we could say where we should kind of hold back. And, okay, we promise we won't send these types of advertisements to your country, or we won't support the establishment of bars in your countries, and we won't do this and won't do that. But we do believe this. Like, we should talk about the values, and it's just not talked about, even though the leaders of two major Islamic movements felt that the values issue was the most important issue. It's just being ignored. That's what a Department of Peace could talk about. And the other thing is with love and friendship, after this terrorist incident in Paris, there was talk about sweeping Europe clean of terrorism, and it's important to have the electron policies to look for terrorists, but so many terrorists feel alienated and feel victimized by prejudice against Muslims. Many of them, some of the 9/11 terrorists, the shoe bombers in England, ISIS fighters from Australia, they've all spoken of the segregation and the hatred that they've felt. And people in the Middle East have talked about the real hatred they feel from the United States, and they believe there's a Christian Zionist crusade against Muslim identity. They really feel this. And why aren't we, for example, sweeping not just terrorism out of Europe, but sweeping prejudice out of Europe? Why aren't we sweeping in friendship and a broader sense of community? That's the positive kind of work we need. So I just wanted to add that in.
Well, that's important. That's important because so much of resistance work is just that. It's resistance. It's uh-huh. trying to stop things from happening. And what you're saying is, let's replace resistance with a positive vision of the future.
Yeah.
In where we want our world to go to.
Well, that's a wonderful little teaser for a couple weeks out when we have Michael Nagler on the show to talk about constructive programs, because one of his concepts of constructive programs is this peace-building work, that we really do need to tackle this as a society. But we'll be back on that subject in a couple weeks. Right now, I want to remind our listeners that we're talking with Kristen Chrisman, who is the author of Taxonomy of Peace, which is a work available online in its entirety at Paradigm for Peace. If you just go ahead and search for that, it'll pop right up. You can also read smaller, shorter bits of it online, one at a time, if you'd like. Kristen, thank you so much for coming on Occupy Radio and sharing your thoughts and your wisdoms and reflections. And is there anything you would like our listeners to ponder after this show ends?
Something that I wanted to say on a little different point of view is that the negotiations are all about, will Iran develop a nuclear weapon? And there's two questions I think that should be asked instead. One is, why would they want to develop a nuclear weapon? Because we have to address those reasons. Why would they want to? And secondly, why is Iran or any country interested in nuclear power? Because the effects on human health of the radioactive waste surrounding these plants is horrendous. And I've read about that in David Swanson's book about the military-industrial complex at 50. And I think that's something that's just being lost in this whole flurry about the negotiations. Why does any nation want nuclear power?
That's a good question, and clearly because of nations feel uncomfortable with the power dynamics that exist in this world. And Kristen, I feel like we will definitely need to get you back on the show, because we just skimmed the surface of what you have to share with us. So,
thanks so much. Yeah. Thanks, Kit. Thanks, Rivera.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And so thanks for coming on the show this week, and we're looking forward to doing this again sometime.
Thank you so much.
You
You're listening to Occupy Radio from KWVA Eugene and the Pacifica Radio Network, streaming at kwvaradio.org and podcasting at occupythemedia.podomatic.com. I'm your host, David Getchy, Sierra Lupe.
Hey, I'm Jim Jones, NSA agent and host of OTMC Live.
Jim, how did you even get in the middle of Occupy Radio?
I'm Sue Sierra Lupe.
You're here too?
I live here, remember?
Oh, that's right.
Join Getch, Dan Marks, Johnny K. Dangers, and me, Sue Sierra Lupe, on OTMC Live, your weekly dose of news, opinions, and sarcasm. New shows are posted Mondays on occupythemedia.podomatic.com.
As long as you listen, I'll be there. I'm Matthew McConaughey. When I'm on my Lincoln and I got my music flowing, I turn it on the dial. OTMC Live.
We're here with Nikki Sakara, who is a water activist living in the mountains of Western Maine. She is one of the co-founders of the Community Water Justice, and Nikki was also recently elected as a water district trustee for the town of Freiburg. And water issues are everywhere these days, and I want to thank you for coming on Occupy Radio this week and sharing your tale of Western Maine's water issues, Nikki. And so thanks for coming on Occupy Radio.
Yeah, thanks for having me back, David. And hello, Rivera. It's good to hear your voice again.
Hi there, Nikki. And we're so glad we get to call you up and check in on this really intriguing and telling, unfolding story. You know, that I heard this little rumor that there's been a recent kerfuffle, let's call it ironically, over the Penobscot River, if I have that right. Why don't we let our listeners know what's going on around that one?
Yes, it's a story that's been unfolding since 2012, when the Attorney General's Office issued the opinion to the Penobscot Nation that the river was not a part of their reservation. So this is a problem because the Penobscot Nation, they're a river culture, and they chose to occupy all of the islands in the river so that they could secure the river itself for their sustenance fishing rights. So by the state asserting, even the questioning of their rights to the river undermines their complete culture. So it put the Penobscot Indians on the defensive, and they brought a lawsuit to make sure that that claim would not come to fruition. And there seems to be some motivation. This lawsuit is being pushed by a number of different municipalities, but even more concerning are the corporations that exist in each of the intervening municipalities in this case. So what this means is these polluting corporations, you know, there's sewage treatment plants, there's a paper industry. They want to reduce the current regulations to allow more pollution to enter the waterways. And so what's preventing them from doing that right now are the Penobscot Indians, because of their sustenance fishing rights. And because of the sustenance fishing, they can only consume so much pollution in the fish that they eat, which makes a more unhealthy scenario for the Penobscot people. And of course, they're looking out for the best interests of all the people that live along the river. It's not just their self-interest that's tied to their fishing. With more industry being built and more population, we need to really look at and value our water.
Lightning flashes in once peaceful sky. So quiet we stare as a star flies by. A glimpse of some power like struggling calm. Outlines the mountains from dusk until dawn. A look in the distance, your monument waits. Tomorrow we'll give you our prayers and our faith. That you'll always be there in spirits you'll fly. As you speak with your words, lightning flashes the sky. Now the moon has a beat over the fields of gold. The wind is your breath and it comforts my soul. Montana sweet, grasses will cry. Waiting for comfort, lightning flashes the sky.
Way up, way up, way up, way up.
Starting, but I believe there's 7 other municipalities that should follow suit with this. So there's one success in this case, and so we need to go around and talk to the other municipalities and simply educate them about the facts of the case, and so we can make a best decision about what's going to be best for the people of Maine. And I think, you know, many people will leave. The process is not complete yet, it's just starting, but I believe there's 7 other municipalities that should follow suit with this. So there's one success in this case, and so we need to go around and talk to the other municipalities and simply educate them about the facts of the case, and so we can make a best decision about what's going to be best for the people of Maine. And I think, you know, and many people believe that polluting our waterways more is not the direction that we need to be going in.
And Nikki, can you, maybe I'm not remembering our conversation as well as I should from last time you're on Occupy Radio, but it seemed to me that this whole story was looking a lot more bright back then. Like they had, the Wabanaki had secured the rights and it was looking like it was heading in a good direction.
Well, there's been many battles. Interesting enough, the last time we spoke, I think we were talking about, because there was a proposed 600 and 900 acre dump that they were trying to put in just north of the reservation, and we managed to get them to back down out of that, and so that was considered a success. You know, I think around the last time we spoke. But there's a lot more going on. You know, for the Maine DEP to get control over the regulatory aspects of this river would allow that dump to come in. Uh-huh. It would allow the paper industry to dump more toxins in the river. And it would also potentially allow an east-west corridor that would bisect our whole state as a utility corridor to export Maine's natural resources to the global market, bypassing our local economy.
Yeah, I think we can't underestimate the significance of this east-west corridor, which is about, it's actually an international oil corridor because it is coming from Canada through Maine back to Canada to the port, if I get the path correct. And that the Penobscot Nation is actually holding it back by asserting their rights to the river. And this is not like a little river either. The Penobscot River is a major river. It has a long history of actually being heavily polluted and heavily destroyed, and a long history of people standing up to stop that pollution and to remediate the effects of our own culture in that river. It's an amazing story, and I'm really glad to hear that what you're finding is that the educational effort is actually drawing out the part of the Maine people who really want to protect that river and to maybe repair some of our relations with our tribal communities in Maine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of healing needed you know, needing to be done on many fronts. And I think, and I love the metaphor of our water being such a healing element, that it could also heal relations. You know, corporate relations right now are the overarching threat overall, and it'll be interesting to see how this one will play out, because also the state of Maine is threatening to sue the EPA because the DEP wants full regulatory authority over the river. So there's that. There's another whole battle behind this going on, which could be the back door for this all to still happen. So it's a big waiting game, and there's a lot of money being thrown at this. And I'm not pleased that my taxpayer dollars are doing this. So, yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, our taxpayer dollars, I can't say that I am pleased with much of what my taxpayer dollars are doing these days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But we're talking with Nikki Sakara, as we mentioned at the beginning of this interview, water activist in the Western Mountains of Maine and one of the co-founders of the Community Water Justice. And this is clearly a developing story, Nikki, and we're going to want to check in with you again to find out where this ends up. But if you want to give our listeners any last dose of wisdom before we go, here's your chance.
Yeah, you know, as always, I encourage anybody to get involved in where they are locally and look at where their water is coming from, what authorities oversee your water quality specifically, and get involved. And always, you know, there's small victories to be had, and look to those always, because environmentally we have a lot of pressure on us as human beings, and every little victory counts. So thank you.
You can find out more about Kristen Christman's work about the taxonomy of peace by just Googling Paradigm for Peace, and it will pop right up. You can also find out more about Nikki Sakara's water issues and those of our whole nations by looking up the Facebook page, A Community Water Justice, which tracks community water struggles all over the nation. And if you're trying to find out more information about where I'll be next on my Seeds of Change tour with workshops and readings, that, of course, can be found at my website, www.riverasun.com, under upcoming events.
Corporations only let you know about the news they want you to know.
Well, what do you suggest as an alternative?
How about you listen to shows made by people who care about you and the world we live in?
Ooh, that sounds good. What kind of shows are you talking about?
Oh, I got a bunch for you. Sunday, All Power to the Positive. Monday, Occupy the Media Collective Live. And Mic Check Radio. Tuesday, Clearing the Fog. Wednesday, Occupy Radio. Thursday, Talk Nation Radio. Friday, Air Occupy. Saturday, Economic Update.
I am in. Hey, where did you find these shows anyway?
Dad, it's called the Internet. Just go to occupythemedia.podomatic.com. Or search Occupy the Media in iTunes.
Occupy Radio is produced on the campus of the University of Oregon. Nathan Stevens is our producer, and we have support from OEMG, the Occupy Eugene Media Group.
Thanks this week to our guests, Kristen Christman and Nikki Sakara. And as always, thanks to my West Coast traveling co-host, Rivera Sun.
Drop us a line, occupiers, and let us know what you're thinking about this week's show or any other topic that comes to mind. You can reach us at Occupy Radio 23 on Twitter and Gmail. We're Occupy Radio on Stitcher and iTunes, where we love seeing your 5-star reviews. Let's just be real frank about that. Thank you. Find us on Facebook and on the Occupy Radio group page, and we are occupyradio.org.
For Occupy Radio, I'm David Getchy, Sierra Lupe. And occupiers, while California is looking at running out of water by this time next year, and Californians up and down the state face $500 fines for watering their lawns. Nestle, the company who famously stated that water is not a human right, is pumping 1.5 million gallons a week from Sacramento's aquifers. But you can bet that Nestle won't be paying any fines by the time we talk to you next week.
It's good to be back here. It's good to see all you again. Take it, dude.
April 15th is Joey Ramone Day, so join me, Marcel, from 8 to 10 p.m. as we celebrate 2 hours of nothing but the Ramones. That's right. So grab a slice of pizza, turn your stereo up real loud, and keep it right here to 90.7 FM as we celebrate Joey Ramone Day from 8 to 10 p.m. on Wednesday, April 15th.
Let's go!
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Art of the Story 11th Annual Storytelling Festival. This year, Washington County Cooperative Library Services hosts its 11th annual week-long storytelling extravaganza, features 17 storytelling performances throughout Washington County. Performers in this year's festival include Judas Black, Sam Payne, performers from Portland's Brody Theater Company, and more. Again, that's the Washington County Library's 11th Annual Storytelling Festival, The Art of the Story, from April 11th through April 18th. More information can be found at